Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
My name's Debbie Marshall. I'm an investigative crime journalist. And for more than 3 decades, I've reported for TV, radio and print. I've written 8 books, mostly true crime, and won a Leadership Walkley Award. And I also tracked down the killer of my own partner. I don't tell crime stories simply for their salacious and sordid detail. I reinvestigate them for a purpose, to try and help find justice. And to this end, I've just spent the past 18 months investigating sensational South Australian murders from 40 years ago. It's led me from the Australian outback to the Adriatic coast into a terrifying world of abductions, killings and cover-ups committed by a shadowy network of pedophiles known colloquially as the Family. Between 1979 and 1983, 5 young men that we know of were abducted from the streets of Adelaide, held captive, drugged and sexually tortured before being brutally murdered. And there were at least 150 boys who were also abducted, raped and then discarded. They were the lucky ones who survived.
Debbie Marshall joins us in this episode of Australian True Crime to talk about her latest book, Banquet, The Untold Story of Adelaide's Family Murders.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Many of you will be familiar with Debbie Marshall's investigation into Adelaide's so-called family murders because of her Foxtel series Frozen Lies and the podcast of the same name. The book, Banquet, The Untold Story of Adelaide's Family Murders, brings it all together, ties up some loose ends, and really clarifies the remaining mysteries needing to be solved for the families of the victims. For those of you who are new to this story, you're about to learn about one of the cases that gives Adelaide its dark reputation. Although only one man has ever been convicted in connection with the sexual assaults and violent murders of young men, it's long been rumoured that a group of high-profile men were involved. Those rumours were only encouraged by the rather flamboyant name of the man convicted. Bevan Spencer von Einem definitely sounds like a villain connected with a grand conspiracy. He was actually an accountant who lived with his mother and spent his weekends doling out handfuls of prescription drugs at gay bars around Adelaide, which made him quite well known and popular on the scene. But Adelaide's reputation was already building. In 1978, the first of eight known victims of serial killers Christopher Worrell and James Miller was discovered in bushland near the small South Australian town of Truro. They became known as the Truro Murders, and they shocked the nation. At around that time, gay men were being thrown into the River Torrens that snakes its way through the city, and sexual assaults were being committed on young men with regularity. But the family murders were something else altogether. Although thanks to a veil of secrecy and a complex web of suppression orders, we still don't know exactly what they were.
This story is so unbelievable. It's terrifying, but it's true. It's so scary and out there.
Yeah.
Anyone who has friends from Adelaide of enough of an age, they will tell you these what sound like crazy conspiracy theories, and you think to yourself, oh, God, come on. But then listening to your show, I realised, wow, I mean, a lot of this stuff is actually true. And now, of course, you have extra stuff in the book. Did you always know that there was a lot of real truth to these crazy rumours?
Oh, not really. I mean, I was circling the story for about 20 years. I mean, I was, you know, when I was really young, I was at university in Adelaide for 2 years, and so the Truro murders had just happened then. So I sort of knew then that there was a dark space there and that it wasn't safe for women or men. And then I started to look at the family murders and knew that I had to be at the top of my game before I went in there because, you know, we all know, as you know, reading the book, it is beyond dark, this story. But for that reason, beyond important to tell as well. So I didn't know. I needed to go in and interrogate what was the truth, what were the lies and what lay in between. And hopefully I've done that as best I can.
And not only dark, but it feels like the perpetrators, the offenders, are incredibly prepared for investigation. So you have to be on top of your game for that reason as well.
Yeah, prepared in that they, you know, they obviously knew what they were doing when they went out on these ghastly hunting trips for young men. But some of them appear to be very opportunistic as well. For example, the last murder of Richard Kelvin, well, if indeed it was the last murder. I'm not convinced that is the case. But if it was, then, you know, that was definitely an opportunistic pickup. I mean, he was literally just, you know, a minute from home, that gorgeous, poor young 15-year-old boy. I mean, it's hard as a mother to actually imagine not just what he went through, but what his family and friends went through.
We'll come to that, but when you say it's hard as a mother, you are uniquely placed, though, because you have lived through early in your life or in your adult life a violent crime. Can you talk to us about that experience and how that's affected your reporting and your approach to victims and victims' families?
Sure. Yep. Yeah. So back in the day, in early 90s, I was divorced and had met a guy called Ron Jarvis who, you know, I promptly fell in love with, and he, you know, fell in love with me back, which helped. And he also loved my young daughter, Louise, who at that point was two.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were a happy little band of merry men for about 2 years. Ron was a fisherman, a gorgeous man, just a country lad, really. But he, unbeknown to me, was also involved in marijuana. And he was hanging out with a very nasty character who I didn't know, a bloke called Stephen Standage. Cut a long story short, Ron went missing one day, and I knew that he had gone off to meet this Standage character. I didn't know why, and he didn't come home. And so I went looking for him for 7 months, and I trawled through the muck of society, absolute muck of, you know, drug dealers and you name it, trying to find out who he was. And in doing that, I knew instinctively that it was Standage, and I found him, and he then started to threaten me with my life. Back off, you'll wear cement boots. It impacted my life so greatly that I had to sell the house. Louise and I moved interstate, but I never forgot him, and I continued to go after him. And then after 10 years, he murdered someone else, and his DNA this time gave him away. And then one day, out of the blue, I got a phone call from Tassie police saying, "Deb, we've just arrested Standage for Ron's murder." And it was the best day of my life because, you know, you have to live through murder and its impact and its terror that it leaves in its wake to really understand, I guess, what it is. And, you know, it's one thing to lose a partner, but it must be incomprehensibly dreadful to lose a child. So of all the books I've done and all the true crime stories and television and whatever, I never forget that. I never forget that I've been through a lot of pain, but by God, what they've been through, you know. So it's always a privilege to hear their stories and to get their trust.
You've just done something that so many victims of crime or their families do. They say, "Oh, but, you know, I meet other people who have had worse things happen and I just remind myself." And that's an incredible thing that so often people say to me who have lost loved ones to violent crime. It's incredibly humbling somehow, it seems to me, to lose someone to violence.
Yeah. Look, I have to say that I was the Crown's chief witness at his trial, at Standage's trial, and, you know, these killers are cowards underneath. They really are. I mean, it's one thing to go after a woman at 2 o'clock in the morning with these phone calls when there's no one there, when there's a young, and he knows that I'm alone in the house with a young child. And, you know, but it's quite another when that young woman grows into an investigative crime journalist is sitting across from him in court going, "I've nailed you, you know, I've helped nail you." And then, you know, my victim impact statement, he wouldn't look at me. I just kept saying to him, "Look me in the eye." And he wouldn't. So I said, "Well, if you can't do that, look up into the body of the court. And do you remember that four-year-old girl who was absolutely heartbroken? Well, there she is. She's that beautiful young girl who's now a journalist herself."
Wow.
"She's the one in the red coat. Look up at her." He didn't.
Wow. Two powerful women.
I know. I tell you what, vengeance is sweet. Don't ever let anyone tell you anything different.
I can't imagine there's many other people who have, you know, and journalists who've like helped solve a murder of their own loved one. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, you know, the cold case, they put a cold case team together down here in Hobart, and they did an extraordinary job. And those boys were fantastic. They kept me in the loop because I knew from the beginning, as I said, that it was Standage. There was no question who it was. They just couldn't put that together. And then when they got him, you know, they did this fantastic sting. And they, you know, got him to almost admit, but enough to get it over the line combined with the DNA.
Where is he now?
Oh, he's in prison. He's serving 48 years.
Wow.
So I finished my victim impact statement by saying, "I hope you never again see the sky as a free man. And I'll bid you farewell to your lonely prison cell while we go off and, you know, have dinners and travel the world and have a lovely life."
Chilling. Fantastic. Yes, your podcast, then you decided to go there. I'm going to say to go there because this story, the family, it has haunted Adelaide and Australia, but really has haunted Adelaide for a very long time. What really happened, because a person has been convicted, but there's always this lingering doubt that he wasn't the only person, that there were very powerful people involved who got away with it, and that there's so much more to the story, and you decided to take up this case. Why did you decide to do that?
Oh, because I absolutely knew in my heart and my gut that it had to be told, and that after having done, you know, six true crime books, that I was ready for this one. And, you know, my my genre is serial killers, really, and unsolved. So I've done some pretty horrific, you know, the Claremont serial killings in Perth, which is now, you know, he's been put away for that, thank God. You know, Derek Percy, who died before they could get him, and he's, you know, maybe, you know, 8 kids in the 60s, and I have no doubt that he was probably involved with the Beaumont children's disappearance in Adelaide back in the 60s. So I was ready to look at the family murders. So what we do know is that there are, so whilst Bevan Spencer Von Arnim, who is a pure psychopath, you know, think Ivan Milat, same type of character, whilst he was convicted for Richard Kelvin, the 15-year-old boy, in 1985, there are 4 outstanding murders. Now, these boys were 14, aged between 14 and 25. Now, in anyone's language, 4 outstanding murders, in my opinion, is not acceptable. So I wanted to go in and have a look at why that was the case, what was going on there. So I started with the Foxtel series, plug here, called Debbie Marshall Investigates Frozen Liars. And I put a call out on that series for people to come forward, and in they came. In they came, telling me stories about being picked up by this, you know, by men and drugged and sexually assaulted and let go. I came to think about that. What did that actually mean in real terms? Well, it meant to me that these were the lead-up offences. And then I started looking at it more closely, and there was something like 200 lead-up offences. And then I did the podcast. And in doing both the podcast and the series, I came to recognise that there were suppressions sitting around people's names. So I wanted to have a look at why those suppressions were still there, and they were put on decades ago. We're talking something like 4 decades in the administration of justice, which is a really loose term, which means not much apart from, you know, it's to protect people's reputations, or maybe put their, you know, if there was going to be a trial so that, you know, it didn't actually taint their evidence. Well, that's not the case today. There is no trial mooted. It is 4 decades old. You know, we're talking generationally now that people are being handed this baton of grief. It just continues and continues and continues. And I think that these suppressions should not be a shield that stands eternal, that we should be now looking at them. So I had 5 suppressions lifted during the course of the series and podcast. That was amazing. That was amazing. And one of the people who agreed to have his name lifted was a guy called Lewis Turter.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was just chilling.
Oh, my God, yeah. It was. Yeah, because you were sort of arguing that, if I'm correct, it felt like you were arguing that the suppressions were put in place for purposes. They're, you know, suppression orders have purposes, mm-hmm. and they were placed there at the time for specific purposes, and then they were sort of just left because they were there, and no one had challenged them in the meantime, and those reasons no longer existed. So why have them?
Quite right. So, and that's, and then I, you know, spoke to lawyers in Adelaide and interstate who had a look at that, and they all came up with the same thing. You know, these suppressions really don't hold any weight anymore. There seems to be not much purpose to them, certainly at the time when they were put on, you know, as I said, maybe a pending trial or what. That's not the case today. So there were lots of names, and we had to, you know, cut down the list of those names, and so that's how we ended up with 5. But there are still names of people that, hidden behind suppressions, that I think it would be really lovely if a lawyer is listening to this, would like to have a chat with me, because I'd be really, really keen to get involved in going back in. I didn't have the resources or the time to do that myself, but I think it's important. Not for me. I think people need to be really clear. This is not about me. This is about the victims and the victims' families who want those suppressions lifted, because they don't want that baton anymore.
Could you take us through it, please, from your, who knows where it began and ended, but as you see it, could you take us through the crimes, this story?
Okay, so it started in the 70s. So if we take our minds back, it was Don Dunstan. So it was the liberation of South Australia, taking it out of that fusty, musty, mothballed image and bringing it, you know, dragging, kicking and screaming into the light. It was Dunstan who, to his full credit, legalised homosexuality. You know, he was an incredible premier. But, you know, he was also, he liked his parties.
I've always found Adelaide a swinging town, to be honest, Deb. I've always found Adelaide a particularly swinging town. Like, I've gone there to tour as a comedian, and I've gone for the festival, so I'll go and spend, you know, maybe 4 weeks there at a time over the years. And it's the kind of town where you're offered a lot of drugs, there's a lot of swinging parties, and the locals are incredibly friendly. And
yeah,
it's the sort of town where you're embraced, and it's a fun town.
It's a good town. It's a really good town. I mean, I love Adelaide. I love it. Yeah. It's a beautiful looking city. Yeah. I love the state. I love the wines. The food, the people are fantastic. But you know, we can't deny this dark side. It exists. It's real. You know, I spoke to a psychologist, and I said, you know, South Australia's got this shocking reputation as being, you know, one of the murder capitals of the world. That's not right, is it? He said, no, it isn't, but it certainly punches above its weight in terms of serial killings. So, I mean, I did the book, for example, on the Snowtown serial killings, The Bodies in the Barrel, the book that the movie was based on. Wow. Mm. You know, that side of Adelaide, that dysfunctional...
The northern suburbs.
Northern suburbs, you know, where you get the waft on a still day of the nearby abattoir. You know, people living in these sunless housing trust houses. And I went in there and virtually embedded there for quite a long time. I can tell you it was horrendous. You know, 11 killings, 12, one was, they were found not guilty. Shocking, shocking story. But then I turned my attention years later to the family murders in this book, Banquet. And that other face, you know, the face of the festivals, the food and wine scene, you know, the gay scene.
Cabaret festival.
Yeah, Dunstan's Adelaide, you know, with its high heels and its lipstick and its, you know, I'm the flashy bitch now, you know. you know, don't put me in the corner anymore. Don't tell me that I'm a second cousin. I'm not. But caught up in all that excitement, and caught up in that liberalisation, became that then started this really nasty underbelly, and we started to see it early in the 70s. Of the drug boys, you know, the sexual assaults, the boys who got away, the very lucky boys who got away, who remain haunted, by the way, well into their adulthood.
The very famous beat along the Torrens there near the university.
Yeah, number one beat. Mm. So you had, and then we had, you know, it started, the decade pretty well started with the drowning of Dr. George Duncan, who the professor, and, you know, there were always rumours at that time of that, and later a couple of vice squad police officers went to court for being possibly involved or allegedly involved, and they were acquitted. Of that. So that remains unsolved. You know, let's go cast our mind back to the Beaumont children and the Ratcliffe Gordon girls, you know. So we're talking stains on South Australia that have been there a long time. And then Truro, and then we get into the Truro killings are astonishingly evil. You know, terrible, terrible murders of young women. And then the family murders. And I called the book Banquet because I came to see it as like a medieval feast, a debauched feasting on young men. So think of it as a hunting party that these men are going out, Von Arnim, you know, one of the Hechirangs. I'm not suggesting in the book that he is or was the main perpetrator, getting these boys in the cars, drugged to the girls and then taken back to houses, one of whom was Lewis Tertius. Where other people would be, Von Arnim going in with other people, some of whom's names are suppressed. And, you know, the door closes and the horror begins. Then we get into the murders. So the first murder, 1979, Alan Barnes, he was murdered actually on his 17th birthday. And it moves through, we've got a 17-year-old, we've got an 18-year-old, we've got a 14-year-old, a 23-year-old, It's horrendous and always the same MO. Picked up, drugged, sexually assaulted. Richard Kirwan was held for, get this, 5 weeks.
Oh, that's so awful.
he was held for so long that his hair grew.
Mm.
And that according to a gay man who kept prolific diaries around that time, and I interviewed his brother who showed me those diaries and read bits of it for the podcast. Horrendous. He was crying. I was crying. A hairdresser, a guy called Dennis and Dennis, who's now dead, went in and cut Richard Kelvin's hair, by all accounts. This is the boy who walked down to the bus stop to say goodbye to his best friend Carl, who'd been hanging out at Richard's house. Richard was the son of the newsreader.
Yeah, he was the son of the newsreader in Adelaide. His dad's really famous. And as a joke, on his way out the door, he's put on a dog lead, like a dog collar around his neck. That's with right. Sort of studs on it.
That's right. And Carl said, take that off, mate, you look stupid. So he took it off and he put it around his wrist. When I went into prison to interview Von Arnim, who's the only guy who's been convicted of the family murders, I went in 2018, and even I was astonished that I got in there to meet him. I said to him, I caught him off guard, I caught him on the hop. He wasn't expecting my question. And I slithered in underneath him and said, was because he'd always told the police that no, Richard Kelvin was not wearing a dog collar. They found him with the dog collar. They found his body with it. I said, was he wearing a dog collar? And he said, yes, he was. I got him.
Yeah.
And that's really important for a couple of reasons. One, it proves that he was lying. Two, if he was lying about that, what else was he lying about?
Yeah.
Because he's always denied that he murdered Richard, and indeed at that meeting in prison he said he blamed Richard. He blamed his victim. He said that he was gay. He was not. And even if he had been gay, so what? What was done to that boy is beyond depravity. And indeed all the others. Mm. And it's not that anyone, that people didn't care about the other boys, but he was, just happened to be, the son of a very high-profile newsreader and a much-loved newsreader. So when his son went missing, all hell broke loose. You know, this was just out of control now. You know, this is the fifth boy from 1979. So Richard went missing in 1983. And, there are no charges. They're not within cooey of working out who has done this, or if they have worked it out, they haven't got enough evidence to charge Von Arnim or anyone else.
So he was walking back to his house, right? He could see his house from the spot where he was abducted.
He took Carl to the bus stop.
Uh-huh.
He waved him off. And the last thing that Richard yelled out, when Carl was mucking around because there were preachers on the other side of the road and they were mucking around to each other as 15-year-old boys do. And the last thing that Richard yelled out was, hallelujah.
Oh.
Mm. He was on his way home. He was scared of the dark. It was getting dark. It was winter. It was cold. And he tried to get home. It always makes me cry. Sorry. He tried to get home and those bastards wouldn't let him.
Was he... no, I know. It's just, it's really unbearable. And
it is unbearable. It is unbearable.
Mm. So he was held by them for 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the longest, it feels, was that the longest that they kept any of their victims? Yeah, it was the worst attack, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It's horrifying.
It was. And, when I was writing the book, I kept thinking, why did they hold him so long? Were they playing that long? Really? Really? Or was there so much heat on them that they couldn't, they had nowhere to put him? It appears that Von Arnim may have dropped him off or pushed him, into the bush at that 5-week mark after he'd taken his mother to a family party. It's a photo of Von Arnim eating cake and drinking tea from a dainty cup and then dropped him and then probably went back and picked up Mum, took her home.
I don't understand. I just can't get my head around this. And it's like I said before, it's like so unbelievable and evil, actually. I think it's the evilness of it that is so frightening.
Well, they were hunting parties. They knew what they wanted. It was boys to order. And, you know, we're not just talking about that group of family murders. There was a coterie of different pedophiles, different groups of pedophiles in Adelaide at that time. You know, one was a guy called Rick Marshall, who's now dead, but he ran the Cottage Theatre. I mean, he had boys on tap there. You know, he would do a play and then sexually assault boys in the intermission. You know, it was like, and then go back on stage. You know, these are horrendous crimes that were going on right through the 70s. You know, and the lead-up offences, the 200 boys with Von Einem and his shabby band of men.
Where did they keep Richard, by the way, for this five-week period? Was he in one of these houses that they had or...?
Possibly. We don't know.
We don't know
because, you know, Von Einem will never give up his secrets. He will take them to his grave. It's his little bit of power.
It's frustrating because Adelaide's a small town and the amount of information that you are able to divulge about some of those people feels like so many people must know who they are. I don't know who they are because I'm not from Adelaide, but I do know that it is the kind of town where, you know, a lot of people would know. So it's like, it's such bullshit. Isn't it? Like, it feels like it's just like, come on. Yeah, again, what is the purpose?
Well, I think Lewis Tertius said it better than anybody could. So that, you know, that is, in journo's terms, that was a really good get.
Oh, yeah.
I was astonished when he agreed to speak to me and I said, you know, can we talk rather than, you know, face to face? And he said, yeah. So 10 minutes later, he was sitting in the back of our hire car with my director.
I can still visualise that in my mind. I was like, because I could hear his nerves mm-hmm. and him saying more than he planned to and more than he wanted to. And I was listening to you in my headphones and I was visualising it. It was such an amazing thing to listen to.
It would be really good, actually, for your audience to actually hear a little bit of that podcast.
Amazing.
I found the way he spoke extraordinary. And it was a really good lesson for me in really listening to not just what people are saying but what they're not saying.
Yeah.
So, you know, you may remember that when he would say, okay, he would rise.
Yes. Okay.
Let's have a listen to that, maybe.
Let's go back to the beginning, Lewis.
Right.
So did you have any involvement with Von Einem?
I had sex with Von Einem.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have anything to do with the murders or that there, so...
Nothing to do with murders at all?
Nothing at all.
How did you come to meet Von Einem in the first place?
Through a friend.
Mm-hmm. Do you know who that friend was?
Yes, but he's no longer here, so I can't really say his name. It's Brian, but I can't say his last name.
Brian Gant.
Yes.
Okay. Brian Gant is also on the list of suppressed names we had lifted. He was another of Von Einem's boyfriends. You know, we all have a circle of friendships.
Yeah.
What was your circle of friendship? Who were the people you hung out with?
Well, most of them are more dead now, so...
It doesn't matter, but give me the name, sorry.
Brian Noel.
Yep, Noel Brooks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Brian Gant. Mm-hmm.
There was Prue.
Prue Furman.
We stopped together through thick and thin, okay?
Gant, Brooks and Furman all appear in Von Einem's court transcripts and Trevor Peters' diaries.
Prue said that Bevan Von Einem frequently took drug young men there to have sex with them. She said that Lewis would always have the bed made and candles ready.
OK, it was suggested that you, you know, with some of the people you just named, the boys were taken to your house and that you made the beds ready for those boys and that you lit the candles for them.
Please know the guys came back to our place, so...
What sort of condition were these guys in?
They were drugged. Von Einem had drugged them.
Do you know what? I think you're incredibly courageous to admit that. So how did you be in a position where Von Einem was taking boys, drugged, back to your house? Not just boys, minors, underage boys who were drugged back to your house. How come, Lewis?
I don't know, honestly. It's a long time ago, so...
How come you got the lucky dip?
I think I was just stupid at the time, okay? But anyway, I can't live.
How many boys, Lewis?
I don't know, honestly.
Roughly?
Maybe half a dozen.
Okay.
But that half a dozen were could see the next morning. Okay, broke up the next morning, left, went home. So,
went home. How would they get home?
By the way, could catch a train home or catch the bus home. That's fine.
Okay, so you say the boys were drugged. How drugged? In what condition were they to be giving consent?
I don't know how they were drugged. Okay. How did they give consent? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. All I know, they came, he dropped them off at our place. He went home. We let them sleep a lot. They left in the morning, so.
Okay, this is not the story I've heard.
Isn't it?
The story I've heard is this, and this is why it's very good that you're getting your right of reply here, your opportunity to tell your side of the story. So the story I've heard is that the boys were dropped off by Von Arnhem. He would sometimes leave them there. He would sometimes stay with them. But he was quite territorial with those boys. The things he wanted to do to those boys.
No, I never saw any of that. Nothing.
You never saw that?
Never saw that there, okay.
But you know that that's what he did, didn't
you? We heard afterwards that's what he did. But he never did that. Why? They came out to my place. I wouldn't let that happen, okay?
Okay. So what would happen to the boys when they got back to your place then?
They usually just sleep off.
Why would you accept drug boys back at your house?
Because I was a stupid fool, wasn't I?
How old were you?
Mid-20s.
Okay. Did anyone have sex with those drug boys back at your house?
I suppose someone did, yes.
Who was the someone, Lewis?
Noel and all those there, but I don't, look, it's a long time ago, okay?
Could you please tell me who had sex with those boys?
No, I can't, I'm sorry, that's going a bit too far.
Okay, so can I assume then, without you naming them, that they were the people that you named earlier?
Yes.
So I'll go through those names. So Prue Furman, who's now dead, suppression has been lifted on her name. Noel Brooks, who is now dead, suppression being lifted on his name. Brian Gant, dead, suppression lifted, and suppression lifted on your name. How come that all the others had sex with these boys and you didn't?
Yes, I've had sex with them, okay?
Okay. Lewis, thank you. Transparency and truth always works because there's no point otherwise.
Okay. You know, in his words, I said to him, what would you say to other people who have suppressions around their name? He said, oh, for God's sake, have them lifted. It's time, okay? It's time. It is time. It's way beyond time that those suppressions are lifted and that we... In the words of a fantastic lawyer in Adelaide, he said, Debbie, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Oh, what a great phrase. It's so true, you know. What was Leonard Cohen said, that's how the light comes in.
It doesn't sound like Lewis has had a great life while the suppression order's on. Was it just laziness or forgetting these suppression orders were on that they weren't lifted, or is there something more sinister at play?
He actually didn't ask for that suppression to be put on. It was just put on around his name at the time. And now his mother's dead. He's agreed to have that suppression lifted. He was willing to share his stories. And I think we need to acknowledge his courage, actually, in not just coming forward to have that suppression lifted or agreeing to it, but also in sitting with me on three occasions and talking to me. I'm sure he did say things that he wished he hadn't said. But it's not easy talking to a journalist at the best of times, and it's certainly not easy when you've got things tickling you awake at night as they do Lewis Turter. You know, some of those memories he's got are pretty awful.
Thank you to patrons Anthea, Helen Howden, Ilonka Rood, Mary Pout, Sass and Lindy Doughty.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
It's believed at least 150 young men and boys were abducted from the streets of Adelaide, drugged and raped by this one loose collective alone, who went on to be known as The Family. That nickname, by the way, came from a police detective during an interview on 60 Minutes, who took the opportunity to assure the public that police were taking action to break up the happy family of pedophiles that was hunting the streets of Adelaide. 5 of the victims of that group are known to have been murdered, although many suspect there were more. The 5 known victims were Alan Barnes, aged 17, who was abducted while hitchhiking on June 18, 1979. His mutilated body was found 6 days later, dumped near South Para Reservoir. Neil Muir, aged 25, with no fixed address. Muir was last seen on August 28, 1979, after being ejected from an Adelaide club by a bouncer. His remains were found the next day in 2 separate garbage bags in the Port River. Peter Strognev, age 14, skipped school on August 27, 1981, and was never seen alive again. A farmer burning off crops in Middle Beach found his charred remains 10 months later. Mark Langley, aged 18, had an argument with friends near the Torrens River on the night of February 27, 1982, and got out of their car. They drove off and returned later to find him gone. 9 days later, hikers found his remains in the Adelaide foothills. And finally, Richard Kelvin, aged 15, the son of local Channel 9 newsreader Rob Kelvin, who disappeared while walking home from dropping a friend off at the bus stop. He'd been held captive for 5 weeks. We've chosen not to go into detail about the injuries to the victims, but suffice to say there was a trademark. Bevan Spencer von Einem is the man believed to have inflicted those injuries, and he's the only person to have been convicted in relation to any of these crimes. He was convicted of only one of the murders, and that's Richard Kelvin's. In 1984, he was sentenced to life in prison for that crime. Debbie Marshall met von Einem in Port Augusta Prison in 2019.
I mean, my opinion of von Einem is not just that he's a coward with brutal sexual fetishes and fantasies, but that he's also probably impotent. I think that he played out. He wanted to be a somebody. He didn't want to be the little bookkeeper that he was living at home with mummy. He wanted to be a somebody. He'd tell people he was a gynecologist or a pilot. No, actually, he was just a creep, a real grub who tragically enacted his fantasies.
Yeah, because his sexual thing was really almost surgical, wasn't it, without going into detail. Like he had really weird fetishes.
It was. Yeah, it was. And, you know, I know that, true crime's everywhere and it's people love it, and so do I love it. I think it's a fascinating genre. But I think we need to be really mindful that true crime is always told for the right reason. It is not entertainment. It is not entertainment. And I wouldn't want people to read my book as entertainment. Please read it for what it is, which is, you know, a very up-close, very personal approach to what happened, lots of ideas and lots of talking to other people about what happened, including getting to someone who was actually inside the investigation for the first time, which is great. but also looking at what was happening generally in South Australia. You know,
well, that's it. I always say that I think true crime is valuable in that it's a window into systems in our society and how they're working and not working. And when you look at enough true crime, you see consistent patterns of systems that are broken.
Yeah.
The suppression order situation is a classic example. You've just highlighted and shone a light on the fact that these orders are sitting there for no reason at all and protecting people for no reason at all. It's a classic example.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. And what I call for in the book, because I don't do true crime for entertainment, because I try to, you know, get behind things and see if they're solvable, I'm just the caretaker of these people's stories, you know. So I'm the voice piece, really, for the families and the victims. I'm calling for a royal commission. They are calling for a royal commission, you know. Let's let the light in. We do have outstanding murders, and going right back to Dr. George Duncan, that's outstanding. Let's have a look at what was going on in Adelaide in the 60s, the 70s, you know, those paedophile groups. I need help to try to get suppression orders lifted. And, it's resource heavy. It takes money. It takes time. It's going to take a gutsy lawyer to want to get behind it, or maybe someone who's retired who has time to do that. I know that there are some really, really good lawyers in this country, and, you know, why not get behind something that is so important? Because most of us are parents, and all of us know that it is not acceptable to have unsolved murders of children or young men. That is not acceptable in anyone's language. So, you know, I think we all need to pull together. I think people need to be voting with their feet, particularly in South Australia. A couple of days before deadline, I was looking for the 14-year-old Peter Stognath's parents. I'd been looking for them for a year and I couldn't find them. And I got to the point where I thought, maybe they're dead. I just couldn't find them. And I got an email from a Pentecostal pastor in Adelaide saying, Mrs. Stognath wants to talk to you. She's seen your series. I went, oh, my God, she's alive. Not just talk to me. She put me on a plane that afternoon. I sat down with this woman who, at the four-decade mark, still cannot accept that it is her son in the grave. Now, if you juxtapose that image of this broken woman begging me to please help her try to talk to someone to have her son's body exhumed again, please tell me it's Peter, Debbie, please find me some proof. What do I do with that? And then you juxtapose that image of her against the image of Von Arnim, you know, this 6'5" bloke cruising the streets and picking up boys that are later murdered. You know, I always think about him and the parents and the victims, because he knows who else was involved in those murders. He's never going to tell us. So we need to try to interrogate that ourselves now. We need to try to prosecute that. Sunlight's the best disinfectant.
How did you find sitting with him? What a strange experience. He's made himself such a mysterious figure, I guess, hasn't he? Because he's gone to prison for the rest of his life. He's never spoken of the crimes. He's never given anyone else up. He's never given any details at all. What was that experience like?
Well, for a start, I thought there was going to be like the, you know, what you see in American movies where there's a window between you and a phone and, hello, I'm Debbie Marshall, you know, and you must be Mr. Von Arnim. There was nothing. It was just him, 6'5", and me, 5'1½", touching knees almost, whilst he sat there and spun this fantastic narrative about himself, spun this fabulous fantasy about what a lovely man he is, and he didn't do it. And actually, it was Richard Kelvin's fault, because he was passive and, you know, it wasn't him until we got to the dog collar, when he realised, and as I say in the book, the words got out of his mouth before he could catch them. And then the psychopath came up. I saw him change so quickly that I thought, whoops, I'm in trouble here.
Oh, really?
I'm in trouble here. And I later debriefed, as I had to, with a forensic psychologist. And I said, you know, for a moment, I thought that he might strangle me. And he said, there's a line between stupidity and courage, and you've crossed it. He wouldn't have strangled you. He'd have snapped your neck.
Oh.
And the guards wouldn't have had time to get to you.
Has he ever, what sort of prisoner is he? Has he ever, you know, enacted any violence inside or?
No. He used to be in Yatala, where he's now in Port Augusta, which is a long way up a lonely road. But Yatala, he had access to younger prisoners. One of whom, for example, came forward when he was released and said, you know, Von Arnim raped me. And nothing was prosecuted from that. You know, he had something of a power trip. He was on something of a power trip in Yatala. Now I'm pleased to announce that he's an old man in the old age unit, complains of having diabetes, little bits of heart failure. But his friend Paul, who sadly died, who was the go-between, his lifelong friend, who remained ridiculously loyal to him, but was a lovely man and just didn't want to turn his back on him, I guess. He gave me all the things that Von Arnim had given to him to hold on to when he went to prison, and one of them was stuff that had come out of prison since Von Arnim has been in there. Newspaper articles that Von Arnim hands around and marks, circles and marks and signs, and lends to other high-profile prisoners, many of whom are pedophiles.
Himself or about?
About the Snowtown murders, about the Beaumont children, about the family murders. Oh. It's like, how can this be? How are they getting access to this? How do they get this opportunity? Mm. No.
Well, I've heard there's a market, you know, because people inside get evidence to do with their own cases, so they get crime scene photos and stuff that they share.
Yeah. Oh, look, absolutely. And, you know, when I went in, he said, oh, because I was told, warned in no uncertain terms by a criminal profiler, be very careful. Give nothing of yourself away. Think Clarice Starling, Silence of the Lambs. It actually was, and I don't mean to sound dramatic saying that, it was actually exactly the same, except she did have something between her and Hannibal Lecter. She said, give nothing of yourself away. And one of the first things he said to me, because they zero in on you, these psychopaths, he said, oh, I saw you on television the other night talking about the Snowtown thing. And I thought, oh, my God. He's not just been tracking me a little bit ahead of me coming in, but why has he been given access to watch the Snowtown
thing? He's so right, yeah.
You know, so as I say, you know, they salivate.
That'd be like porn to those guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's wrong. Yeah. It's so wrong. So, you know, all of it is in the book. And the other reason I called it Banquet, not just because I saw it as a debauched feasting on young flesh, but when I was just nearing the end of the book, I found a quote by Robert Louis Stevenson that said, when I was nearing the end of the podcast, I found a quote by Robert Louis Stevenson that said, everyone sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences.
Oh.
And I put that to Louis Serta. Everyone sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences. And he sighed and said, well, I guess this is my banquet.
Oh.
You know what? They all need to go to the banquet. It's time.
Do you know what became of the other people? I know that you that we know who some of the other perpetrators were, some of the transvestites, for example, and people like that. What became of them?
Well, we don't know who else was involved in the murders.
Right.
We do know through Louis Turter telling us stories that Von Arnim, with some other people whose names are suppressed. By Turter's account, went back to his house on a couple of occasions that he knows of, and that drug boys were taken back there and were let go the next day. We know that.
We know the hairdresser died, you know, don't we? The
Dennis and Dennis died, and he was a very close friend of Von Arnim's. There were some transvestites who died. Prue Furman, for example, whose name was suppressed and that suppression was lifted. There were others. But the other thing about these suppressions is, which I found extraordinary, and I'm happy to stand corrected here, but my understanding is that when that suppression list was put in, that people are contacted. Are you happy to have your name, the suppression lifted? Mm. Well, how many people are going to say yes? Lewis Turter, to his credit, did. One transvestite, for example, her family was approached. She's now dead. And they said no. So suppression remains. Mm. I don't get that.
No.
Suppression's around dead people? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, I think we just need to always come back to the question of the great injustice in all of this, you know, the unsolved murders.
Are Richard Kelvin's parents still living?
Yes. Both? Yeah. And it took me a long time to come to it as a journalist. You know, we always want to talk to everyone, don't we, firsthand? Yeah. But I made a conscious decision not to approach the Kelvins. Yeah. The person who did approach me on the back of the series was Carl, the young boy who was with Richard the day he went to the
God,
bus stop.
God, how is he?
He contacted me. He's a mess. Yeah. He's a broken adult.
Yeah.
And he said, I have never been able to discuss this in all these years. And as I say in the book, nothing assuages his grief and his guilt that he was the survivor.
I bet.
Nothing.
Yeah.
But I said to him one day, Carl, you know, maybe have you considered getting some help? And he's done that, and he's come back fighting now and saying, let's do this together, Debbie, let's go and, you know, do whatever we can, and calling himself for people. If you know something, please, please come forward.
Good on him.
And I say in the book, you know, that the day he rang me and said, Debbie, I'm getting some help and I'm feeling better, I'm feeling stronger, I'm feeling so much better, I say in the book, hallelujah.
Oh, God, good on you. Had he never had counselling before you suggested it?
No, he hadn't, but hallelujah, you know, the last word those two boys said to each other. But his mum, by Carl's account, and his Richard's father, beautiful, beautiful people.
Yeah.
So I didn't approach them, and I do hope that, you know, they probably won't read the book, but that they do understand why I chose to write it. It certainly wasn't for entertainment's sake. My mum was a, you know, a real mum, as in worried about her kids, fretted, as we all do, I guess. And Richard had a bit of a cold, and she fretted about him going down to the bus stop in winter, you know, and why is he late coming home? And so she was talking to someone years later, a police officer, and he said, when is it hardest when you look back? And she said, because it had been winter, she said, when the leaves fall, that's when it's worst. Here I go again crying. It's just, you know, I've wept buckets of tears doing this story for the last few years, but I can't imagine what the, you know, people like Alan Barnes's mother, Neil Muir's mother, Peter Stognef's, you know, the parents, the mothers, the fathers, the siblings. This is for them.
Thank you to our guest, Debbie Marshall, author of Banquet, The Untold Story of Adelaide's Family Murders, which is available now. Thank you to our patrons, Misty Hall, Belle Smith, Tracy Southey, Elizabeth, Renee Portland, and Renata DiVincenzo. And thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smartfella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.